Doomberg, the green chicken that needs no introduction. Welcome to the Competent Investor. How are you?
Tom, congrats on the new show. Happy to be here. Looking forward to another fantastic discussion. Always enjoyed our conversations on your other platform, and I know that this one's going to be even more successful.
Well, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I always look forward to getting to speak with you and really digging into and kind of challenging a lot of the thoughts around, let's say, the way that the mainstream or the way that you would, let's say, reactionarily respond to much of these changes. And it, you know, it's seemingly unfortunate that every time we speak, there's these like massive geopolitical events taking place. You know, we happen to have been scheduled to speak on the morning of the Nord Stream pipeline attacks, for example. And now it seems that the tune of Trump is, you know, has dramatically changed on working towards peace in the Ukraine over the last day or so by him saying that the Ukraine can now win back its entire occupied territory in its original form and maybe even go further than that. So this, of course, changes the implication of the U.S. not being directly engaged, let's say, with Russia. So what do you think in that calculus has changed?
So this is a perfect example of our development of what we call mental models, and using lateral thinking allows us to have a wholly different view than what's being reported. Trump did not do a 180 degree change whatsoever. He's trolling. Mm-hmm. If you read that Truth Social piece carefully, he's saying, sarcastically, sure, Europe can go beat Russia. I've studied the problem carefully, as if, you know, Trump studies problems carefully. And he says, you know, go ahead, knock yourselves out. You can beat Russia. I have no doubt that you can retake Crimea. It might maybe even march all the way to Moscow. That is clearly trolling. I saw an article in the Telegraph today that finally got it right, that said Trump is washing his hands of Ukraine. You know, after butting heads between Putin and Zelensky for months, he's come to the realization that this war will be settled militarily. It will not be negotiated. Mm-hmm. And nobody in their right mind thinks that Europe and Ukraine can defeat Russia in a conventional war. It's just not going to happen. Trump knows that's not going to happen. So when you reread that post through the lens that we immediately read it through when we saw it, mm-hmm. and then you watch the roller coaster of excitement amongst the globalists that somehow Trump is finally on board, to their realization that this is actually the exact opposite of how they initially interpreted it, I think it's going to be a very bitter pill. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole intent of Europe is to get the United States directly involved in a military conflict with Russia, because they know they can't defeat Russia on their own. They can't afford to buy the weapons. Ukraine doesn't have the soldiers to give those weapons to that could defeat Russia in a war of attrition. And, you know, we often say on podcasts in our writing that this war is lost, and we get questions about that statement. I mean, the war is a stalemate, they'll say. There's no such thing as a stalemate in a war of attrition. In a war of attrition, there's the larger side and the smaller side. And land doesn't matter in a war of attrition. Wars of attrition tend to end suddenly when the smaller side reaches a breaking point. The whole entire reason that Ukraine and Europe are trying to get the U.S. directly involved and are seeking ceasefires is because the war is being lost. Last thing I would say, there's a difference between the war is lost and Ukraine has been defeated. When we say the war is lost, it means that it can't be won.
Yeah.
The final defeat of Ukraine has not yet happened, but it will eventually, because this is a war of attrition. And so Trump's Truth Social post, which we think is quite regrettable, if Trump is going to wash his hands from Ukraine, which we believe he's wanted to do since before he was elected, he should just say that. Be honest with people. Don't play these games. Like, it's unfortunate that you have to become skilled in the art of reading a Trump Truth Social post to understand what he's trying to say. That's not necessarily a healthy thing, but wildly wrong interpretation of that post, at least initially, from Ukraine and its European allies. Trump is washing his hands of Ukraine, in our view. Whether he sticks to that, you know, Trump has a tendency to pivot to the position of whoever has last spoken with him. But that's our view of it. When we saw it, and then we saw the media reaction to it, we couldn't help but roll our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's actually why I ask the question in that way, because, you know, if you read that post, you automatically think, you know, it is serious, because it is a very serious matter, right? And this idea that we have to be able to be translators and read through what's actually being said or written is, I think, a very detrimental thing that ends up creating more news and angst than it otherwise should.
I mean, this is the hallmark of Trump for his whole career, for good and for bad. But anybody with any experience reading Trump's tweets before and now his Truth Social posts has to see through what that post was. Mm-hmm. Frankly, it didn't even read like it was written by him. There was a conspicuous lack of all caps, if you know what I mean. And so it was a weird post. Trump's under a lot of pressure. The uniparty neocon wing of Washington, which probably is 80% of Congress, never saw a war they didn't like. Hasn't really won a war in a very long time. The Granada doesn't count. And yet they still are anxious to get into the next one, like in Venezuela and all the stuff that we see going on. It's really bizarre. I don't quite understand it. Let's take Lindsey Graham. Like, what do the people of South Carolina care about who rules the Russian-speaking portion of the Donbass? It's a great mystery to me why Lindsey Graham spends a disproportionate amount of his time on the Ukraine issue as the senator from South Carolina. I get that he is, you know, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee or whatever, but, you know, I would begin with what the people of South Carolina want and need. How's the education system down there? How's the poverty levels? What are the tax rates like? How are the bridges? How are the roads? How are the schools?
How's the energy infrastructure?
How's the energy infrastructure? Yeah, exactly. I mean, this disparity between the needs of the governed and the attention span of the governors, the leaders, political leaders, is really remarkable. The greatest disparity, of course, is between the European Union, the European Commission in Brussels, and the people of Europe. And, you know, this can't go on forever. Like, there comes a point where the people will rebel.
Well, I mean, directly to that point, Doomberg, you know, you recently wrote that Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea continue to produce advanced weaponry at a scale that vastly exceed NATO's current capabilities. So how does NATO not see this? Or do you think it's recency bias that informs their ability to project power?
I don't know. Like, Russia alone is outproducing NATO by a factor of 4. And then we have Keith Kellogg sitting in Kiev saying that Ukraine's winning the war. And if the US got involved, sure, there's a whole nuclear weapons thing to worry about, but, you know, we would kick their, you know what? And I was like, this is, if the US could have kicked Russia's, you know what, it would have done so a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I just, it's a real mystery. I don't understand it, Tom. Wish I did, you know. Russia, it goes back to, you know, the whole, what I would call the sort of Peter Zeihan Western techno-arrogance. There's an assumption that the West is omnipowerful, superior, richer than these countries. And like, I've been to China, I've competed against Russian companies. Indian companies, like, there's incredibly sophisticated, well-educated people doing amazing things in these countries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last I checked, we got some issues over here. And so it is what it is. Let's hope that they don't, you know, sleepwalk us into the abyss. But it's a bizarre situation. I don't have an answer to it.
What do you think of the, let's say, the survivability of the UN at this point? You know, 16% of the budget comes from the US. Do you think that, you know, again, that they were kind of sleepwalking into this position where NATO actually gets itself into a position where it does have a come to Jesus moment and does realize what its actual power is?
Do you mean NATO or the UN? Because you sort of pivoted.
Oh, I'm sorry, NATO. Question.
NATO, okay. Because yeah. The UN is a whole different issue, which we can discuss. I think Trump would leave NATO if he felt he could get away with it. genuinely. NATO has run its course. The U.S. is going to focus on the Western Hemisphere, needs to focus on the Western Hemisphere, needs to rebuild its military supply chains, needs to look inward and to reindustrialize and rearm before it can project power in Asia, in particular. Look, NATO threw everything they had at Russia and lost. That is a profoundly consequential statement. Not a popular one. It's not one that gets repeated in the Western media very often. But as objective analysts, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons and financial support were poured into Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And Russia's going to win that war. Losing wars is hard. And we've said this on many occasions. Losing wars is hard. That's why you try really hard not to get into them. And no country has been more destroyed by this whole adventure than Ukraine. A true travesty, true tragedy, a reprehensible tragedy that the people who put Ukraine in this position will never be held to account. But it is what it is. Very sad, tragic, actually. And yet it grinds on. Like Trump's post feeds the delusion of Europe into thinking that they could inflict a strategic military defeat on the world's most powerful nuclear superpower. Like it, not even close. And it's because of this Western techno arrogance that Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. Like Russia, the Russian people are incredibly sophisticated. Like they're totally self-sufficient. The sanctions war has failed, utterly failed. The combination of Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea is formidable. Like, what is France going to get? What is the, take Britain, United Kingdom. 80,000 troops total in their army. A couple of aircraft carriers that sometimes work. What are we talking about here? Like, I was watching with great puzzlement the United Nations Security Council meeting over this whole Estonian airspace violation, false flag. Let's call it what it was. And the speech from the British ambassador to the UN just like lecturing Russia in the most harsh tones possible, threatening Russia. Like, I want to say, you and what army? Like, what are we talking about here? Are we on the same planet? Like, the British Empire was 100 years ago. Like,
Never mind the fact that they're also, in the midst of needing a bailout from the BIS.
Keir Starmer has, 13% approval rating? We're in a very dangerous and delusional period where the old powerful countries in Europe, because they're not powerful anymore, are led by delusional people who are wildly unpopular, and they are suppressing free speech. They're suppressing elections. They're undermining the election results in country after country after country. This is unsustainable. Ursula von der Leyen is an unelected bureaucrat, is probably the kindest word I could use to describe her. And she's lecturing us about, quote, our democracy. And when she says our democracy, the emphasis is on our, not democracy, as in her democracy, as in her power, her rule. The European Union is in its last innings, and the war in Ukraine will have been, the EU's Waterloo.
So, Doomberg, it seems like there's so much geopolitical turbulence, and seemingly more than usual, with, let's say, Venezuela, as you mentioned earlier, also being the target of more focus from the U.S., as you've been writing about as well. How should we be thinking about, as Trump says, losing countries to the deepest, darkest China?
Yeah, so you're actually referring to India there with that post. And by coincidence, our upcoming Doom Zoom, which we hope to publish probably on Monday, is called Losing India, What a United BRICS Means for Energy and Geopolitics. And that's a pretty important moment. And, as we say at the beginning of that presentation, the past few weeks have brought historic and momentous change to the geopolitical landscape. And these are events that will no doubt be seen by future historians as truly transformative. And the way we have sort of developed a mental model around what's going on is that the decades-long struggle between the global South and the Western-based financial order is reaching a critical juncture. And the actions of one country, India, could prove decisive. And we go into why that is. And we look at India through the lens of energy and how Trump demanded the impossible from them, and how India in particular is extraordinarily sensitive to protecting its sovereignty, just given the way it became an independent country in the chaos of 1947 after all those decades of British imperial rule. And so, you know, the Trump administration assumed this was the weakest link. And in fact, we think it was probably the worst of the BRICS countries to attack. But we have modeled the current situation as World War III since about 2014. And it is a war between the Western-based U.S. dollar financial system and the BRICS countries. It's no surprise to us that Brazil and India, B and I of BRICS, are the recipients of the harshest tariffs. And the all-out assault on India has been quite remarkable. Richard Nixon famously said, even paranoids have enemies, right? And if you just look at what's been going on vis-a-vis BRICS, let me just sort of recount a series of events. So Iran joins BRICS in 2024, and suddenly there's a missile war between Israel and Iran, with Israel sort of acting as a U.S. proxy. Indonesia joins BRICS in 2025. What do we see? Oh, attempted color revolution in Indonesia. What a surprise. Indonesia happens to be the largest, India's source of exports for coal. 60% or so of India's coal imports come from Indonesia, and suddenly there's a color revolution there. Color revolution in Nepal, yeah, right next door to India. Mm-hmm. Bangladesh last year. Suddenly, you know, the war, the skirmish between Pakistan and India. And then the H-1B visa situation as well is basically a direct assault on India. And that's because of, you know, 70% of the H-1Bs go to Indian nationals. And I think some $35 billion of remittances flow as a result of Indian immigrants in the U.S., the vast majority of which are probably here on H-1Bs. And so you're seeing this all-out assault on India and the pushing of India towards Putin and Xi. And that's kind of where we are.
You know, it's so interesting to kind of try and, again, parse these or translate these texts when the last time Trump mentioned or said, you know, losing countries to the deepest, darkest China, he didn't mention Brazil, right?
Yeah, well, Brazil's an interesting case. We've written about this before. You know, it's the only member of BRICS in the Western Hemisphere. And that's not necessarily a great thing for Brazil, in our view. And so we'll see. I think we're going to see a lot of political interference in Brazil. We're already seeing this sort of social media war with the judges in Brazil. If the U.S. is truly going to focus on the Western Hemisphere and is washing its hands of Ukraine and will let China and Taiwan figure things out without U.S. military intervention, then that actually means dangerous times for Brazil, in our view. Of course, dangerous times for Venezuela as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've mentioned that a few times, but that's something obviously very much at the top of our radar as well.
Well, you know, trying to zoom out and understand, let's say, more of the trajectory of where the world is headed, China has been stockpiling critical minerals consistent with needing to go to war in the near future. You know, there's certain cases where we can kind of look at what is possibly being telegraphed here. So do you think that's a decent indication of them actually preparing for war, or is that just the, let's say, the cautious nature of a political party that runs that country in a very strategic and long-term way?
So I think the military parade during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting in Tianjin, you know, the one that followed that meeting, sorry, the celebration for the 80th anniversary of World War II, those two meetings came right on the heels of each other. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting preceded the 80th anniversary celebrations of the end of World War II. And that military parade was really a profound statement on the part of China to the U.S., saying that you do not have military escalation dominance over us. Whether that message was heard in Washington remains to be seen. It was a remarkable sight. I think the people who are saying that these were all, you know, styrofoam fakes are incorrect. Our own personal experience with China's industrial development would indicate far from that. And of course, military might is a derivative of industrial might, which China now has in spades. And so China doesn't feel like it needs to invade Taiwan, is our view. They are probably going to execute the Hong Kong strategy, where they just run the clock out and ultimately take it without shots being fired. And their objective is to convince the U.S. that it cannot be defeated economically or militarily. And I happen to think both of those are true. Not only stockpiling, but monopolizing supply chains around critical military industrial complex materials, rare earths, germanium, you know, aluminum, magnesium, iron ore. But the other thing China's doing at scale that is kind of interesting and something we're writing about next is building a huge infrastructure to convert coal into oil products as sort of the brute force way to circumvent its one energy strategic weakness, which is a lack of domestically produced crude oil. And this can be done. It can be done at scale. It has been done at scale historically, and China's doing it at a scale that would blow people's minds. China is using more coal to make chemicals than I think the U.S. burned last year. And so something we're fleshing out in the next piece called Backstop, temporarily called, at least that's the title, Backstop. You know, energy is fungible. China has a lot of coal. It's going to do what it has to do. I would think that China's objective is to convince the U.S. that entangling militarily with China will go at least as bad, if not worse, than entangling with Russia has gone. And by the way, all of the learnings from Russia having confronted NATO's best weapons have undoubtedly been shared with China and Iran. That's sort of a secondary catastrophic outcome of the war in Ukraine.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that you went right into the energy piece with China, and that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. You know, we see, as you mentioned, this move to be able to convert coal into other, or the molecule of coal into the other molecules that they need, as you say. So interestingly, and then when we couple that with their increased building out of their nuclear infrastructure from an energetic standpoint, not necessarily a weapon standpoint, you know, again, this is a country that recognizes this vulnerability or this lack that they have and is moving in the direction to be able to address that vulnerability. And it seems directly in contrast with much of the West.
With notable exception of the United States, of course, which is an energy gigapower, and that fact is the foundation of Trump's planned manufacturing renaissance, which we think is both totally appropriate and totally possible. But back to China. We did a presentation in, I think it was July of 2024, for our Doom Zoom, our pro tier, called Year of the Dragon, China Through the Lens of Energy. And I think that presentation has aged quite well. Mm-hmm. China's going to produce as much domestic energy as it can. And it's going to work as hard as possible to limit its energy vulnerabilities. It has two. One is that it doesn't produce nearly as much oil as it needs. And the other is it doesn't produce as much natural gas as it needs. The second one's a little easier to fix. And they just went a long way towards doing it by signing the Power-Siberia 2 pipeline agreement with Russia. Russia has an infinite supply of natural gas. It could power as much of China's natural gas needs as China would be willing to allow for supplier concentration risk. You know, China does not like to be sole supplied on anything, understandably. But the oil one's a bit more challenging. So the two things that it has done is it has made itself indispensable in the oil refining business. So if China is shorted oil, many, many countries beyond China will feel it when they don't have diesel and jet fuel and gasoline that China is producing and exporting. But then they're also doing coal to chemicals on a huge scale. And I think that's being sort of underestimated by people internally. At round numbers, I think, again, need to do some more analysis, but I was just punching up some numbers with my handy calculator this morning, and I think they're up to like 700,000 barrels a day of oil equivalent from coal, which is meaningful, by the way. This is, you know, a fair, not, you know, it's not a majority of what they're short, but it makes the spreadsheet, as we like to say. And it proves that it can be done. So.
Doomberg, as we're on the subject of energy, I feel like there's possibly a tide turning, and I've noticed the tide turn, you know, just with myself watching, let's say, auto manufacturers over the last year or two, kind of turning away from EV only complete lines. And you've been noting as well with the moves by countries whose grids have become overly reliant on solar or wind power. Do you think the promise of the green futures tide is starting to turn in the public and the industrial eye?
Oh, sure. I think Trump has unlocked a tsunami of executives who feel empowered to tell the truth. It's a shame they didn't have the courage to do it when the political environment was less conducive to do so. We were writing this, of course, when Biden was president. You know, the entire architecture of the green energy transition is just built on a fundamental lie, which is that you can wean yourself off fossil fuels with no sacrifice to your standard of living. And that's just not true. It's plainly not true. It is provably not true. It is a giant fabrication. And you can get away with that at the margins. 2-4% solar wind on a grid is not going to be anything that people are going to notice. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of backslapping and, you know, feeling good about yourself. But once you get to a certain penetration, physics takes over. I mean, I'm happy to explain why it must be, which I guess I should just do. Solar and wind are intermittent. And in order to use solar and wind, a grid operator needs to make huge investments in order to make room for them. Why? Well, when solar doesn't show up, you need backup. And when solar is there in abundance, too much, you need to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And there's no scenario where either of those things is accretive to the benefit of the grid. So let me partition the source of electricity into three categories. Sources that are capable of being, you know, baseload, so they're there 24/7. Sources that are capable of being dispatchable, so you can dial them up and dial them down really quickly, which is useful for a grid who needs to perfectly match supply and demand, you know, grid operators who need to perfectly match supply and demand. And then there's intermittent sources like wind and solar, who are neither dispatchable nor baseload. So coal...
Nor really storable on
right. Yeah. Well, okay, so batteries are dispatchable, but they're not baseload. Mm-hmm. You know, so once you sort of partition all the sources into these buckets, which we did in a sort of promotional presentation we made called Cocktail Party Trivia, Winning the Renewables Debate with Friends and Family. Let's walk through the fuels. Nuclear, baseload, not really dispatchable. Doesn't like to be dispatchable. Coal, baseload, doesn't really like to be dispatchable. Natural gas, baseload, highly dispatchable. Great, great fuel. Impoundment, hydroelectric dams, baseload and highly dispatchable to, you know, to the minute. Mm-hmm. Those are great, right? Solar and wind are neither baseload nor dispatchable. They are intermittent. Once you have the penetration of intermittency exceed dispatchability, things break. By definition, if you just think about it logically, Tom, if I have 20% solar on a grid, and I have 15% natural gas on a grid, and that's my only source of dispatchability, what happens when it's dark? There's not enough natural gas you can ramp up, right? And we see that everywhere. It's amazing how often we have to see it before people realize what's going on. I blame the grid operators who weren't complaining loudly enough because it was politically risky to do so. California, way too much solar, not enough dispatchability. So like, yeah, Diablo Canyon in California is a bit of a challenge on super sunny days because you're not going to turn down a nuclear power plant and suddenly there's too much solar energy. So what do? They give it away to their neighbors. If California was a closed grid, if it didn't have its neighboring states to bail it out, that grid would have collapsed long ago. Just would have. It is a, it is a huge cancer on their neighboring grids. Like they are a parasite to their neighbors. Mm-hmm. Demanding power when the sun doesn't shine and giving away power when the sun is shining because they've installed way too much solar and their grid does not have any dispatchability. Batteries won't work because you just can't buy enough of them to back up as much as you need. They're dispatchable, they're not baseload. And so the ideal grid, let's say the swing in demand for electricity goes from 70 to 100 every day. The ideal grid would be 65% baseload, 35% dispatchability, and no intermittency. And you would just use those dispatchable sources of electricity to perfectly demand match. And you would have the foundation of your grid be cheap, 24/7, reliable baseload power. And once you add too much intermittency and you swamp dispatchability, they just do everywhere. They broke in India. They broke in China. They broke in France. They broke in California. They broke in Germany.
Portugal.
Portugal, Spain. They're broken in the U.S. Northeast, New Jersey. Everywhere you add too much solar and you don't have enough, prices go up, reliability goes down, and deindustrialization swiftly follows.
Yeah, it's just, again, these situations where reality reasserts itself, I think, is a big part of what's coming in the next, 5 years in not only these pieces of energy infrastructure that have been invested in so heavily, never mind, what we talked about with NATO, all of these different things. It's like there's been many mistruths that have been sold to the public and feel good, but yet when we step back and try to really understand the reality of the situation, it's completely orthogonal many, or most of the time.
Yeah. And completely misportrayed by the media. So you have a shocked population when they realize, like, there's been a lot of lies told to us here. That's the thing that we love about energy. And that's why energy is the foundation of our analysis, because like there's an answer. Mm-hmm. Here's the physics of it. Here's the direction it must go. The path function of it going from here to there might not be knowable, but you know where it has to end up. And that's a pretty good edge in life and in investing. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think the future considerations are, considering that we have all of the, all of these oil producing nations like Saudi Arabia, for example, that is now, again, kind of changing roles and kind of partnering with Pakistan. There's so much upheaval in this space. How does this, play into OPEC and these existing relationships? Is this kind of a commodity that is going to be demanded no matter what? And those relationships can change and there is going to be turbulence, but either way, we still need that energy, right?
Oh, sure. We see a bifurcation of the energy markets potentially evolving here. Mm-hmm. BRICS, Global South, and G7, Western world. We see this already with Russian molecules flowing south, mm-hmm. and to Asia, and Europe being heavily dependent on US LNG. I think we're going to see, in our view, the BRICS countries, the Global South, are going to replace treasuries and European debt with gold for their neutral reserve asset. And they're going to settle imbalances in energy trades using gold. And that is going to drive the price of gold much higher, in our view, not investing advice, of course. We're long gold, full disclosure, a fair amount, not a life-changing amount. And so, like, yeah, the easiest bet in the world is that humanity will consume ever more energy. Mm-hmm. The world will reorient its politics, its geopolitics, and its economics to continue to consume more energy. And in an unfettered world, I think Russia is going to be a major supplier to the global south. Russia can produce far more oil and gas than it does today. And one of the big consequences of losing India is that there's going to be huge demands for Russian energy. And Saudi Arabia is a big mystery. You know, this whole mutual defense pact with Pakistan could be read a couple ways, back to our linear, our lateral thinking approach. When we saw that headline, much like when we saw Trump's Truth Social piece, we had a wildly different interpretation. Mm-hmm. So the headline was, Pakistan lends its nuclear umbrella to Saudi Arabia. We view it as U.S. proxy gives security guarantees to Pakistan in war with India.
Right.
If you view Saudi Arabia as effectively a U.S. proxy, and then how could you not? Right now, we think Pakistan is the fulcrum country. If India is indeed lost, there's going to be a lot of troublemaking going on in Pakistan today. Again, this is all pulled from the presentation that we're going to put out next week, so it's kind of top of mind for me, mm-hmm. Which I suppose is good. But like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, who have a long track record of collaboration and mutual defense and stuff, but there's a different way to view that, right? Which is this just another shot at India from the US. Mm-hmm. And we note with interest, like clockwork, right? That in Foreign Affairs, the latest edition of Foreign Affairs, is a piece called Why America Should Bet on Pakistan. You know, it's not like they're trying to hide it, guys. this is what's going on, right? And in fact, I think China's objective, who also has a very close relation with Pakistan, is to try to mediate some form of sort of detente, at least, if not peace, between India and Pakistan. And we'll see, whichever way Pakistan goes, is going to be interesting. But there's a concerted all-out effort on the part of the U.S. to court Pakistan to, you know, create trouble for India. And so it is a fascinating geopolitical time, Tom. It really is.
I was going to say, is that the next place we can expect a color revolution?
Well, we'll see, you know. Venezuela, of course, Colombia, Bolivia. It's funny, like, it's very easy to be cynical, but like when you see the same pattern over and over and over and over again, like, it was not shocking to us that fresh off of joining BRICS formally, Indonesia, a coal powerhouse, a nickel powerhouse, is suddenly, you know, protests over social media strategies and various other things. This is just a classic, you know, playbook of the USAID, National Endowment for Democracy type stuff, which allegedly was all rolled up after Doge, but nobody really believed that, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Doomer, you mentioned this idea of settling trades in gold and, you know, this shift in how economics and, in some ways, commodities and money, real money, works in the world. And something I want to kind of take a little bit of time to lay out here and get your thoughts on is this idea that the US is maybe going to use crypto and stablecoins to devalue its $37 trillion in debt. So this is an idea that not only has been, you know, talked about kind of through the media here, but it's also been recently warned about by one of Putin's close advisors. And Michael Saylor of, you know, Bitcoin fame has expressed the idea a little bit differently. And he explained it in a podcast, and he said, the US should dump all your gold, buy Bitcoin, then the trade is free. You buy 5 million Bitcoin for the cost of the gold, and you will demonetize the whole gold asset class and our enemies that hold gold in their banks. So their assets would go to zero, and our assets would go to 100 trillion, and we would control the world's reserve capital as well as currency. So how do you see, number one, let's say those comments, and also how the Genius Act and these stable coins could potentially, you know, absorb some of the US's debt?
Okay, this probably could come as a surprise to you, but we have a different view on the matter than Michael Saylor, noted Bitcoin evangelist. gold has been money for 5,000 years. It's not money today. There is no money today. So let's start there. Money serves three roles. Medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. The US dollar is not money because it is not a store of value. And Bitcoin is not money because it's not a unit of exchange. And gold is not money because it's not a unit of exchange. So when you have no money, you have to select vehicles to execute those three pillars of what money is separately. And in the settlement of imbalances in international trade, you need a store of value above all else. Mm-hmm. If you're imbalancing your trade with China and you're suddenly sitting on a bunch of Chinese RMB, you may not want to own that. You can't spend it. Gold is universal. 5,000-year track record. It's liquid. Can't quite spend it, but it's convertible to fiat currencies of all kinds rather quickly, especially if you're willing to have a little bit of a wide bid-ask spread. And so in Michael Saylor's ridiculous thought experiment, it assumes that everyone else just assumes Bitcoin is valuable to them in a world where gold is already on their balance sheets and they're going to trade amongst themselves and use gold to settle those imbalances. We have a different and more cynical view of what's going on with crypto and stablecoins and the Genius Act. The U.S. is functionally broke. Well, we don't think the U.S. is broke. But functionally, it is very difficult for the U.S. to refinance the wave of debt that's coming due that was taken out at lower interest rates and now is staring at higher interest rates. So here's what we think is going on. And if you read between the lines or even just listen to what Scott Bessent says and take him literally, the U.S. would like to trigger a boom in cryptocurrency trading. And most people's on-ramp into the cryptocurrency world is to buy stablecoin. And stablecoin operators are now by law required to buy short-term treasuries, mm-hmm. which creates a perpetual bid for short-term treasuries.
Doomberg, just to clarify, is that the stablecoin issuers that are based in the U.S.?
Sure. The U.S. is the biggest crypto market, right? So take, Tether or Circle or pick your favorite. If they grew to $3 trillion in market cap, that's $3 trillion in short-term treasury perpetual bid. All of that interest goes to the stablecoin holders. It's a form of financial repression. Mm-hmm. And next up, book it, is a separate debt instrument designed for stablecoin operators that will be at a lower interest rate. Sure, that the 1 year T-bill is yielding 4%, but the stablecoin T-bill we're going to issue to stablecoin operators is only going to pay 2%, and they will be legally mandated to own it. It's a form of yield curve control, mm-hmm. In a way that still allows stablecoin operators to profit. Because their cost is nothing. They're just clipping those coupons. The people giving the US dollars aren't getting a yield on that. They're getting a crypto token to go play in the crypto casino. Mm-hmm. And whether they lose their money or not is of no interest to the US Treasury. And so that's coming in our view. I know that's a bit out there. The whole point of this exercise is to create a bid for T-bills and then to dictate to the stablecoin holders that you're just getting this lower yield. Mm-hmm. And you and I will not be allowed to own crypto, stablecoin T-bills, let's call them. They'll be designed for and sold to stablecoin operators who will just have to, like it, as we would say.
Well, I mean, why would you want to if the yield is half of what, you would, if you wanted treasuries?
You're not allowed to own them. You're a stablecoin operator and you are submitting to U.S. law and you will buy these 2% yielding bills, mm-hmm. and you will like it.
What do you think the mechanics of actually dumping, as you said, let's say $3 trillion worth of debt into that market is going to be?
It relieves the pressure valve of refinancing. Mm-hmm. And again, once the market is established, the regulators can just decide what the interest rate is. It's a form of yield curve control, mm-hmm. ultimately. This is what we think is coming. Like, the whole purpose of this is to force certain actors to accept a lower than market yield. A stablecoin operator is not putting their own capital up. They're taking a VIG off other people's dollars. You can toggle that VIG and they won't leave the market. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So like, if you and I were operating Tomcoin, right? And people gave us $100 million. And the government said, you have to put that in T-bills and those are yielding 4%. Great, we're making $4 million a year just by providing this software, mm-hmm. essentially. And if we're 2 years into making $4 million a year, and they come to us and say, yeah, hey, sorry, you have to buy this special instrument now that only pays you $2 million a year. We're not going to turn it away.
We're going to double our appetite for it.
Or we're just going to say, all right, well, $2 million is still free money.
Yeah.
Still buys a lot of good seats at restaurants. You know, maybe take a nice cruise. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's what's coming. And who's going to feel sorry for stablecoin operators? They're a little seedy anyway, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so they're gonna get everybody hooked, and then they're just gonna, you know, like everything else, just squeeze their suppliers.
Well, and this is why I wanted to help kind of clarify that point, because it's not necessarily that it's dumping the existing debt into the stablecoin market; rather, it's just having another avenue or another alley to kick that can down the road.
Right. It's creating a bid for your debt that is interest rate insensitive.
And
in other words, and mandated by law, right? Somebody will take that $2 million that you and I might be offended at, mm-hmm. in the Tomcoin hypothetical. But that's actually, I think, an instructive thought experiment, right? Mm-hmm. Especially after a few years of collecting $4 million, we'd probably be all right with collecting two. We're in pretty good shape, you know, paid off the mortgage. We got kids' college paid for. We got, you know, we're in pretty good shape. We're going to turn away this free $2 million a year because it used to be four. No, that's not how it's going to work. And so, especially if they decide that's the law, mm-hmm. and they've decided that's, you know, the first part of it is the law. And then the second part's coming. Just what, mark my words.
So, as we're on the subject of the treasury market, how tied are the treasury market and the stock market? How tied at the hip are they right now?
Yeah, we put out a piece yesterday on this exact topic, and credit where credit is due. Our friend Luke Roman at Tree Rings has been on this for a while. His view, and we believe it to be correct, is that the treasury market is backstopped by the stock market. And the simple reason is, strong correlation between tax receipts and stock returns, capital gains taxes, economic activity, all that jazz. Mm-hmm. And can't let the stock market go down now because it would sink the treasury market. You know, $37 trillion in debt, $2 trillion in change each year in deficit spending, entitlements run amok, fraud everywhere, military industrial complex, you know. Huge amount of fraud in the Pentagon, huge amount of fraud in the Pentagon. That gravy train, you know, is kind of rubbing up against it here. Like we're at the edge of what's possible. So, you know, it's an incredibly challenging situation. But, you know, $37 trillion in debt, like a trillion used to really mean something. There will come a time where you and I are on this show and we're talking quadrillions. Right? I mean, it feels sort of Weimar, doesn't it?
I was going to say, you know, as crazy as that sounds, it's probably not actually that far away, considering the, you know, the exponential nature of inflationary cycles like this.
Yeah, compounded interest is a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, the inability of the human mind to be able to consider what exponential growth actually is such a difficult thing.
I'd like to say the knee of the exponential certainly feels linear.
Yeah. But Doomberg, let's talk through a little bit about the actual, you know, the tangible ramifications of why the treasury and the stock market are so tied. You know, taking tax receipts, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a rising, look at California's budget is the most extreme version of this, right? When venture capital is go, and you know, IPO market's wide open, California has a, you know, surplus, and then they have huge deficits, and that's all because of you know, look, rich people pay most of the taxes and rich people have all the investments. And when rich people are flush, they pay taxes on their gains and they spend a lot of money. And what if the stock market were to correct tomorrow, the US Treasury market would break. Now, that means monetization is coming. And I think that's the exact sort of phrase we used in the piece, which is it would create a crisis until monetization would naturally follow. And one thing the Fed has taught the market is in a crisis, it will monetize. Mm-hmm. So that's coming. So ultimately, there's no way to time this. There's no way to trade it. Mm-hmm. You just have to realize the direction of travel and hedge against inflation. I think that's where gold and land and, you know, companies with pricing power are nice to own. You know, Duberg's a great hedge against inflation. We can always just raise our prices. And so, you know, I mean, countries have survived hyperinflation, not the end of the world. It's very disruptive, destructive, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Germany had Weimar, then Germany became a manufacturing powerhouse. Japan was destroyed in World War II, became a manufacturing powerhouse. These things cycle.
Mm-hmm. Duberg, as we wrap up here, something I want to kind of start making a practice of on this new show is thinking about maybe an important skill for people to learn, whether that's, you know, being more critical about reading Trump's tweets. What could be something that you would say would serve a lot of people kind of going forward here that have made it to the end of the interview?
Sure. I think training yourself to think laterally is both doable and valuable. There are people who are natural lateral thinkers, and there are people who are natural linear thinkers, but everybody can embark upon a lateral thinking exercise. And the core to lateral thinking is having no emotional attachment to the correctness of your axioms when you're embarking on a brainstorming session. So we choose those words carefully. It was the subject of our last Doom Zoom called Lateral Thinking, an inside look at one of our most important tools of analysis. And I'm more than happy to assume something that I know is wrong and ponder what that might mean, because it allows you to think differently about problems and to crack open new possibilities. Whereas linear thinkers try to prove that their axioms are right before they embark on a brainstorming exercise. And their objective is to find the right answer as quickly as possible. Whereas the lateral thinker is trying to find interesting possibilities to ponder and to iterate on. And lateral thinking can be very powerful to break through stuck problems, to interpret the news in the way that we do. Because we develop mental models. You know, one of our famous mental models was Trump wants Carney to win, long before Carney was even a contract you could bet on Polymarket. And having that mental model at hand allowed us to interpret the news in ways that that others couldn't. Mm-hmm. And another one is that NATO has lost the war in Russia. Well, when we know that NATO has lost the war in Russia, we see Trump's Truth Social post, we know exactly what it means. He's just washing his hands. He's getting out of the conflict. Let Europe, pretend like it could defeat Russia and then, you know, confront reality. You know, our mental model of World War III exists, and it's a war between the dollar system and BRICS, allows us to view the India news flow in a whole different way. And all of those models could be wrong. They don't actually need to be right. We'd like them to be right. They probably need to be plausible. But lateral thinking is a powerful tool of analysis. And if you can do it well, which can be done via training, you know, Competent Man Podcast is the name of the show. You know, supplementing your linear instincts with some lateral thinking skills will certainly make you more competent.
And coincidentally, I think it was the sixth or something conversation I've released on Competent Man is with David Murren, and that's 80% of what we talk about is the difference between lateral and linear thinking, and, you know, kind of building that skill as well.
Yeah, when I get off here, Tom, I'll send you a magic link to that presentation, and you can put it in your show notes for anybody listening. They give a free copy of our Pro-Tier talk, and it's one that we're proud to put together. Might be a little different than Murren's interpretation. We have our own, but I think there's a lot of overlap in it. And you've heard both of us describe it, and it sounds like that's pretty similar.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it is an absolutely invaluable skill in this time, as we need to, you know, also move towards having lateral thinking leaders, not just linear thinking leaders.
Well, you need the pair.
Yeah.
Either in isolation is not optimal, but a great lateral thinker and a great linear thinker paired together on a problem is pretty formidable. So,
absolutely. All right, of course, all of your excellent content is all available over at Substack, doomberg.substack.com. Doomberg, always appreciate the time, man, and it's always an honor to speak with you.
Yeah, congrats on the new show. I know you're going to crush it. Big fan of yours, as you know, and always a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you very much. Always appreciated.